I'll make a start then, on this forum. Welcome to this Consistent Democrats discussion meeting on the recent attempted pogrom and riots in Britain. The provisional title of this talk is Starmer's Pro-Zionist Government: Genocide and Pogroms Go Hand in Hand. That's the title that I've got as a for what I'm going to say, if that's all right. And I intend to speak for about half an hour, if that's all right. I think there will be other people joining, so I'll just keep an eye on that and welcome them as they arrive, But just to start off on this, anyway, I'd say that even from afar, and I was out of the country at the time, it was obvious that the recent wave of anti-immigrant race riots, which were in fact a nationwide attempted pogrom, was not beaten back by Starmer and his pro-Zionist genocide supporting or genocide denying, you could say, governments. Because the problem is that however many police they sent out to supposedly deal with those who were trying to burn down mosques, in etc. in early August, they were bound to be ineffective. And the reason is obvious, because the government fundamentally agreed with the rioters on many things. As David Miller has pointed out, the leading figures who incited the riots are in effect Israeli agents. And that's particularly true of so-called Tommy Robinson, who is the Stephen Yaxley Lennon, the most prominent British fascist today, whose political projects have been funded by Israel through various covert channels for many years, and who's been proudly photographed with the Israeli army riding on tanks. Paul is here now. Welcome to Paul. Riding on tanks, etc. The motive for the attacks on Muslims is retribution and intimidation of a community that's been pivotal in building the mass movement in solidarity with the victims of Israel's genocide in Gaza. And however much the government tries to evade the point, Starmer clearly supported the genocidal actions of Israel when, in an interview with Nick Ferrari on LBC on the 11th of October, I think it was last year, he justified Yoav Gallant's stated intention to deprive Gaza's human animals, and those were Gallant's words, of food, water, and power. And Starmer said that they do have the right to do that. He clearly said that. I said that was Starmer's real position. And everything he says now is evasion dictated by fear of political discredit or even possible prosecution for providing political support for the crime of genocide that the International Court of Justice even considered plausible in its judgment in January. Hello, Emma has arrived. Welcome to Emma. And the atrocities since then make it more than merely plausible. As he stood to be Labour leader in 2020, Starmer made a point of stating that he supported Zionism without qualification. And the Labour Zionists who fund him to this day, actually abhor the mass movement in solidarity with Palestine just as much as far-right thugs like Yaxley do. I mean, they prefer state repression. Things like Prevent and lies about anti-Semitism to burning down mosques, because that's not really a very good look, is it? But they do have a lot of agreement. And there's a smear campaign that's going on against the group of independent Muslim left-wing MPs who defeated New Labour in the general election. Bizarrely, the government's accusing them of intimidation, when in fact they clearly won the popular vote in these constituencies, sometimes by huge margins, actually. The implication of that is that the population don't have the right to vote out Zionist thugs and liars. So there's a clear coincidence of interest between the Starmer government and these pro-Zionist fascists who incited these riots. Now, another manifestation of the Starmer regime's affinity to the far right is its support for Maidan Ukraine, which is basically run by Nazis for the benefit of US imperialism. And it also has a genocidal policy of seeking to eliminate the Russian-speaking population of Donbass, which is the southeastern part of Ukraine, and the overwhelmingly Russian population of Crimea. And the evidence of Nazi domination in Ukraine is overwhelming. Even the Jewish president of Ukraine, Zelensky, who was groomed by US imperialism precisely to try to camouflage the Nazi domination of Ukraine, he was filmed leading a standing ovation in the Canadian Parliament last year for a 98-year-old veteran of Hitler's SS. You know, Zelensky is a Zionist and is part of an increasingly common phenomena of those who are, you know, Jewish people who are willing to forgive the Nazi Holocaust of Jews as long as the Nazis direct their genocidal proclivities against their enemies, against Arabs, against Muslims, and against Russians. You know, so support for Nazi Ukraine and its supposed fight for freedom against the Russian population of its own country is literally the case that they want rid of that unwanted population. They see it as unwanted. Support for that is a point of honour for Starmer and New Labour. You know, not that the Starmerites won't throw a certain number of fascist lumpens into jail for fighting the cops. Not that some of them won't get severe sentences and lose a lot. They will, you know. That's a given. That's what happens to overtly criminal elements who brazenly defy the police when they involve themselves in behaviour that the ruling class finds inconvenient. They get more than just a slap on the wrist. A certain number will get 10-year sentences for riot, and a few already have, you know. But the rise of this racist lumpenism is a product of neoliberalism, of deindustrialization, and the shrinking of the working class resulting from that. And New Labour offers no relief from that economic suffering, no strategy, just more of the same. And the bourgeois media, of course, works overtime to incite such lumpen layers against foreigners to make sure they don't revolt against capitalism itself. So this government shares many of the hatreds and bigotries of the rioters. They too want to punish refugees and migrants. They too think that Muslims should be forced to shut up about the oppression and persecution they're suffering so often from today in Britain. And in particular, the government think that blacks, Muslims, and other oppressed groups are inclined to show solidarity with the Palestinians, who've been marching for 10 months against the brutal Zionist mass murder of the people of Gaza, should be made to shut up. And they should be made to shut up for them, along with the left, who they've willfully driven out of the Labour Party by the hundreds of thousands to prove their fitness to rule to the billionaire capitalist class and the Zionists. So in that, the government agree with the likes of Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, with Andrew Tate, with Lawrence Fox, with Trump and Farage even, who chimed in support of all this, and all the other criminal far-right elements who incited these riots. So what happened is, on 29th of July, there was a terrible triple murder of three young girls in Southport, and the wounding of several other small children, apparently by a deranged British-born teenager. This was extensively lied about on social media by these fascists and attributed to a completely fictional Muslim refugee. And over the following week or so, there were terrible attacks on migrants all over the country. Mosques were attacked in attempted arson attacks. Hotels that were reputed to be accommodating refugees were also subjected to arson attacks. Non-whites were physically attacked in the streets by groups of racists. In Manchester, a black man was challenged as to whether he had a problem with us English before they violently attacked him, this mob. You know, and in Hartlepool, an Asian man was brutally attacked simply for walking down a street that had been taken over by a mob of these racist folks. In Middlesbrough, fascist rioters set up checkpoints on the road to make sure that drivers that were coming down the road were white and English, with the threat of violence and even potentially murder against anybody who was not white and English. In many places, these thugs waged pitched battles with the police, who in some situations were the only thing standing in the way of members of racial minorities being brutally attacked and even murdered. On the 7th of August, there was a call to attack mosques, hotels that are being used to house refugees, lawyers who defend migrants, and all sorts of immigration centres, and all sorts of other targets related to Muslims and various migrant communities. And that that call was done right over the country. You know, it was supposed to be a British version of Kristallnacht, which was the massive Nazi pogrom in 1938 that laid the groundwork for the Holocaust. And the likes of Yaxley Lennon and Farage would love to see such a pogrom in Britain, but it never happened. And it's no thanks to Keir Starmer that it didn't happen, because what stopped it was mass demonstrations across Britain organised at short notice by the anti-racist left. And the SWP's Stand Up to Racism front was one major locus of this organisation, but far from the only one. You know, the many independent campaigns that fought so valiantly in the general election, returning five independent MPs, along with several more near misses where the Zionist racists in New Labour were challenged and came close to defeat, they also threw their mass base into this effort. And from Walthamstow in East London to Brighton to Liverpool to Sheffield, Manchester, Birmingham, Bristol, Newcastle and more, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, turned out to demonstrate against the fascists, to defend the Muslim communities and to support migrants. And they massively outnumbered the miserable groups of neo-Nazis, it turned out. In several places, small groups of fascists were massively outnumbered by anti-fascist, anti-racist demonstrators. And these thugs, who were previously in pitched battles with the cops over their supposed right to attack minorities, suddenly had to be rescued by the same cops from huge crowds of anti-fascists who would have made mincemeat out of them otherwise. And that was actually a major tactical defeat for the fascists. And neither the government, nor the police, nor the state itself had anything to do with it. In fact, Keir Starmer, our non-esteemed Prime Minister, attempted to ban Labour MPs from taking part in anti-fascist demonstrations. And there's one prominent black Labour MP who refused to abide by this and spoke publicly at an anti-fascist demonstration in Norwich. That's Clive Lewis. And unlike in the case of the seven MPs who had the Labour whip removed for defying Starmer over the two-child benefit cap, Starmer has not dared to do the same thing to him, which sort of mirrors a bit what happened with Diane Abbott in the general election, when Starmer was forced to reinstate the whip to her after attempting to purge her for the sacrilege of publicly doubting if Jews today suffer from systematic racial oppression, as is true for non-whites. Starmer actually fears taking on the black community at the same time as he's waging a war against the Muslim community. So the forces of the state did not drive back the fascists, nor did the government. And stiff sentences for some of these far-right rioters are something of a fig leaf, really, to hide the government's inaction and refusal to mobilise politically against the far right. Because, as I said, the Starmer government agrees with the far right on many things. And that's why it ran in the general election and for the last few years as a flag-shagging, Union Jack-laden party, advertising its patriotism in a manner that sort of reminds you of the way Donald Trump in the US wraps his campaigns with the bloody stars and stripes. In Britain, the Labour Party wrapped its campaign with the Union flag. You know, in some ways, that symbolises its adherence to the anti-migrant creed of the Tory and Reform Brexiters. And it's very cynical. I mean, prior to the 2019 general election, Starmer cynically manipulated the sentiments of many in the Labour Party, including most Corbynites, who opposed Brexit, not out of any faith in the capitalist neoliberal bloc that the EU represents, but simply because of its anti-migrant thrust. And he put forward a proposal for a second referendum with Remain on the ballot paper in 2019 and called for the reversal of Brexit simply to sabotage Labour's election prospects under Corbyn. And it's worth noting that in 2017, Corbyn actually tactically accepted the narrow results of the Brexit referendum and campaigned for a soft Brexit, maintaining the rights of EU workers. And he came close to winning the general election using that tactic, robbed the Tories of their majority. And Starmer's policy destroyed that by a brazen demand to overrule a previous popular vote before it had even been implemented. And that acted as rocket fuel for propelling Boris Johnson into Downing Street. But his real motive was to destroy the leadership of Corbyn because of its modest programme of social democratic reforms, which the boss class will not tolerate, and because of his relatively weak but real criticism of Israel and support for the Palestinians. So what we have today is a neoliberal Zionist government that's carrying on with the austerity that characterised the Tories. I mean, it's determined to keep the two-child benefit cap, which is a major driver and has been for several years of terrible child poverty. It's now removed the winter fuel payment for all but the poorest pensioners, those that are not on pension credit. This is why the supposed fuel price cap is going up. Yeah, and this will cause thousands of pensioners to die, as Labour MPs have said. It'll cause thousands of pensioners to die because of the cold in the coming winter. And this is money that's literally being taken straight out of the mouths of pensioners in the UK, who have the worst pensions in Europe, and sending the savings to fund Zionism and Ukrainian Nazism. Yeah, that's what the government is doing. Yeah. Like Boris Johnson, they want the bodies of pensioners to pile high, as he said in the COVID period. He wants the bodies to pile high so they can fund their far-right cohorts in Israel and the Ukraine. So expecting this government, this racist anti-working class government, to do anything to deal with the threat of racist violence is a forlorn hope. Is that even their law and order measures against the so-called law and order measures against the far right will inevitably be used to attack those who are resisting far right violence. You know, an example of that, there was already an example of that, the scandalous arrest and suspension from Labour of the black councillor Ricky Jones from Walthamstow, who actually, at a rally, he called for Nazi terrorists who were then rampaging and terrorising minorities all over the country to be executed by having their throats cut. Anyway, I mean, however crudely expressed, that's a completely understandable emotional response to large-scale racist terrorism. And the fear that this attempted pogrom caused amongst minority communities is enormous. Such a response is quite natural, in my view. It would be perfectly reasonable if a left-wing government faced with such attempted mass pogroms resorted to summary execution of the worst participants. You know, that would be reasonable, actually. The idea that minorities can only rely on the police to defend themselves against such a systematic attack is a joke. Everybody knows that the police themselves persecute and abuse ethnic minorities, and regularly turn a blind eye to racist crimes. And the list of scandals on that goes back many decades, if not centuries, actually. And in fact, if the mass demonstrations that Ricky Jones participated in had not happened, the far right would have won. You know, I mean, we think that needs to be systematized, with the creation of independent working class militias that centered on the trade unions, with the social muscle of organized workers behind them, and their capacity to cripple the capitalist economy if the state tries to crush and outlaw such events. And to do that, the pro-capitalist trade union bureaucracy that blocks such things needs to be politically challenged and defeated. That's the way to defeat fascist terrorism. That would have the effect of breaking the bourgeois state's monopoly of organized violence. And revolutionaries in Russia used these very tactics to deal with the fascist Black Hundreds in that situation. In tandem with independent working class action against the fascists, we need working class resistance against austerity. So we need political strikes against the attacks on pensioners. We need a general strike against renewed austerity. Because this has the potential to unite the whole working class, if you think about it. Because in the end, we're all destined to be pensioners. You know, everybody's in the same boat on this, you know. And uniting all such battles and struggles, we need to crystallize a real mass party of the working class. And such a party would not see its role as passively standing in elections, but rather using elections as a platform to garner and mobilize resistance in struggle. Ultimately, we need to unite the many left-wing trends that have emerged from the Corbyn movement over the last several years in a project to create a broad, genuinely working-class party that can develop politically beyond social democracy and fight for these things. And that's the purpose of our involvement in the Socialist Labour Network, to try and create the conditions for such unity and political development. So to summarise, our perspective should not be one of fighting for a reformist parliamentary government that can fill in the gap while the Tories recover from their latest crisis, and let alone, you know, a red Tory regime like Starmer's. Our perspective should be of creating a new party of the left to fight for a workers' government based on mass organisations of the working class. And I will leave it there and open it up to discussion. Thank you, comrades. Cheers. Who wants to speak? Sorry, my voice is going.
Could I just ask a question then to clarify,
Certainly.
how we label the movement? You've called it racist lumpenism, basically a pogromist kind of movement. To what extent is it a proto-fascist street movement? It doesn't have the same discipline as, say, the brown shirts in the 30s, where you have this kind of militarized street movement. There's quite a lot of spontaneity and football hooligan-esque kind of. There doesn't seem to be much strategy and tactics involved. I mean, that call out, if it was a genuine call out for pogroms on the 7th, I mean, they've spread themselves pretty thin. It doesn't show much awareness of a kind of militarized kind of strategy to be truly effective. Can we say that this is, you know, one of the tick boxes of a fascist movement? Or to what extent can we say that?
Well, I've just come back on that. I mean, I think it's at an early stage, but that is the objective, you know. They are weak. They are disorganized. Robinson is not particularly a Hitler in the sense of being a, you know, that charismatic and a skilled organizer on that level. But that is what they aspire to do. It's very, very clear that that was their objective, that when they put out that call for a nationwide mobilization, and that list on the online list was distributed of targets, that was the intention. But it was thwarted by the left, and it was a good job that they did, you know. We are stronger than they are. And we need, that is what was proven on the 7th of August. I was actually away. I was in Thailand at the time. Actually, yeah, on my way there anyway. But yeah, they're not strong enough to do what they want to do. We are stronger than they are. The problem is that's always been true. It was actually true in Germany under the days of Hitler, in the lead up to Hitler's victory. The workers' movement was stronger than the Nazis then, but it pursued tactics that divided and weakened it and laid the basis for Hitler's victory. Now, fortunately, we're not in that situation. We did actually succeed in driving it back. It's in a weaker position than we are. But there are always possible, there are always dangers in a situation like this. There is, however weak, there is a nationwide proto-fascist movement. That's what was proven by those incidents in the days leading up to the 7th of August. It proved that the test of strength was on the 7th, and it proved that the left is much stronger. It's stronger to the order of several orders of magnitude, and we saw that in Brighton. And we have a picture on the article on the riots on our website of the situation in Brighton, where there was a very small group of fascists were confronted by a huge crowd of 5,000 anti-fascists, and they had to be escorted out by the police. They were scared. And there's something similar happened in Liverpool, I believe, to the EDL or the proto, or what was the EDL? I think they call themselves the Football Lads Alliance now or something like that. But they are the same thing, basically. They had to be escorted out of a very sticky situation with a huge crowd of anti-fascists in Liverpool. And I've heard of other things. There have been other instances as well, where such things have happened, and just generally on a nationwide scale, it was the left. It was not the SWP can't claim all the credit, but their front group Stand Up to Racism did provide a certain level of organisation that others then joined and broadened out. Particularly the independent lefts who stood in the election and who won some seats. I think there is a movement of the left which probably a few years ago didn't exist, but it's come into being because of the witch hunt in the Labour Party and the resistance to it outside the Labour Party. And this was a test of strength. There's no doubt about it. I think we came out well, but we have to solidify it. That's my message. That's the message that as a Trotskyist that we should be put forward. It needs to be solidified, but we're not trying to build that in a sectarian, in a sect-like way. We want to propagate that more broadly and solidify it in a non-exclusive manner. But nevertheless, it has to be solidified. Sorry, Tony wants to speak. I'll let you come in, Tony.
No, just no. I remember reading somewhere that, in terms of it being a street fascist movement, I remember reading that in France, you have got the basis much more of a street fascist movement, which is the basis of, the National Front, whatever it's called now. I don't know. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, sure. I think the Rassemblement National is much stronger than the far right is in Britain. That's a fact. I think we're in a different situation. We might find ourselves in such a situation in a few years, though, because the pseudo left or the liberals, the Macrons of this world, who is not that different from Starmer, really, more like Blair, actually, more like a kind of Blairy type figure. Albeit he's mutated out of the Socialist Party into his own independent group, but somewhat similar to Blairism or something that's mutated from Blairism. He's been in power for several years, and of course he came to power as a supposed lesser evil to Le Pen anyway, and Le Pen has got stronger under, the Front National has got much stronger under his rule, So yeah, I think the French situation is much more dangerous at the moment. But actually, what happened in early August was a shock. It was a huge shock, and it was in some ways it was the fascists taking advantage of a new situation in Britain with a right-wing Labour government coming to power, as opposed to the Tories who'd overlapped with the far right for years and years anyway. The people like Braverman and whatever, Patel and Lee Anderson, people like that overlapped with the far right anyway, But now you have a bureaucratic Labour government, a very, very right-wing neoliberal one, and they use that situation, that change, political change, to mobilise. And for a while, they were quite successful until the left mobilised against them. And I think that was a tactical defeat for them, actually, quite a considerable level.
And you know the way that the Starmer government has reacted, with this, this tough crackdown and, prison sentences, for what, relatively sort of minor offenses, I would say, and directed it at very young people who are not really, it's just going to really alienate those communities. And, the way that they've reacted shows that they don't really have any answer to the underlying problems. This is their way. It shows the authoritarian streak of Starmer.
I agree with that as well. I think there are different types of people involved in these. Some of these thugs really do deserve to be shot. Never mind
Sure,
sent
sure.
down. But there are all sorts of people involved in it, and some of them are probably could be salvaged and. But the problem is that the Starmer government is a neoliberal government. It won't offer people anything, so it'll just make the situation
No, it's just
worse.
yeah.
We
Anyway,
are the
yeah.
real opposition to that. Not we as this group, but we, the left, in a more broad sense, are the real opposition to the neoliberal government that we have now, which is not that different from the one we had beforehand. There are different nuances, and there are elements that are far to the right of the current government in the last government, but nevertheless, the overall thrust of it was not that different. That's how I see it anyway. Sorry, who else wants to speak? I've been speaking too much, actually.
Well, I'll say a few words,
Yes,
right?
of course, yeah.
Well done, Ian. I think you made a very detailed and particularly important introduction, where you are linking the process through which the left of the Labour Party, or most of the left, was thrown out, at the same time in a process where, in fact, the bourgeois leadership of the Labour Party is driving, like all the bourgeoisies, towards the right and further to the right, which means that they are being taken over by high finance capital, politically, that is. And you can see it in the way the JLM was instrumental, and the Israeli embassy, they were instrumental in that transformation, or rather in this evolution of labor. So you could see there the arm of imperialism from outside, which was plunging into the labor structures and using the fact that they are bourgeois in order to bring them into collision through lies. The fact that they have used lies shows that they do not have a strong case. If they had to accuse the left of anti-Semitism, and that was not the case, they were fake accusations. That shows how weak this manipulation was. And the fact that David Miller has continued to think and to stay involved is an expression of this weakness on the political and ideological level of what is taking place, which is a huge, massive movement in every capitalist countries towards the right, and with the permission for all the sectors the most the most dejected and angry and disorganized, giving them a platform and putting amongst them provocateurs. I think it was correct what you said, that amongst this, behind all of these, the riots and many, there was the instigation of agents. Of course, we cannot say which and when, but this is how it works. And so I think it's important then, to have noted, as you have, Ian, that this was a movement of the right which came almost desperately after the huge mobilization and victories of the left and of the independents in the election. So this election really, though it looked like a reinforcement of Starmer, I think it was, it is a massive weakening of his of his organization, because there is already in there all the elements to rebut. We have all the elements, and David Miller has sorted it out. We have the arguments to rebut all the lies that have taken place, and to explain how these riots have been a desperate attempt at stopping the political development of the left. And these independents, they are not independent from politics. They are independent from right-wing Labour, or from Labour, or from the Starmer. I think this is very important as well, because it doesn't mean they are independent from socialism. I think there is a great opportunity for us to analyse the nature of that independence. Perhaps you correct me, Ian, but it seems to me that all this rebuttal of the right wing has taken place in the streets, but without the trade unions. I have not seen the involvement of the trade unions. I think this is the capital problem, is that the working class, I know it is no longer an industrial working class. The industrial working class has disappeared, but still a working class is a working class. And at the moment, what is happening is that it is being robbed of leadership, and what imperialism has managed to do through the intervention from outside in the Labour Party was to put a wedge between the left, the left, the base of the working class, which was, by the way, in constant strikes upon strike upon strikes in the last 5 years, 4 years, uninterrupted strikes, sometimes coming together in sympathy, and that was already beginning to develop, and yet you see this came to cut the leadership, which is the political expression of the working class, to cut it off from the base of the working class and the trade unions. I would like later on to come back much about this. I think much has to be said about how to address the trade unions. And to link this process, like one of the friends has done with France and other parts in Europe and the world, I think what happened in the last period has been also, even though Israel continues to murder and to devastate Gaza, which is now being completely wrecked, even though they have the power to do this, the United States, the Biden leadership had to look like it was appearing to be critical in some way, or don't go so far, you know. Though that, of course, they have voted $20 billion in support of with weapons to I think it's to Ukraine, perhaps it's to the Israelis. They feel that in front of the force which makes capitalism, imperialism, and even Starmer wanting to appear like, you know, we are not completely against the working class, we're not completely bad, and we are going to sort out a settlement for the workers. All this shows that there is a potential, and this is, I think, what Ian was showing, a potential which needs organising, which is not yet organised. In which we have a lot to do. You know, there is a huge place of work for us if we really take this seriously. And then finally, about Ricky Jones, he's in my trade unions, he's in my GMB, and you're quite right about what you said, Ian, about him. Now there is going to be one of the court appearance on the sixth of so I will keep people informed if they want to attend and if they want to give support.
No issue.
I haven't seen the campaign started, but me and the comrade, we will start the campaign if nothing else is done. And then finally, I note that the SLN is meeting soon. I think this is tremendously important that there will be David Miller will be involved amongst others. I think perhaps closer to home, we should look at what Andrew's Finstein is doing, because I saw in an article he wrote in the Camden New Journal, he said that he wants to develop local democracy, and he has said that several times, and he talks about people's assemblies, and I believe that he created one, but I do not know if it is still working. So I propose that we keep looking into these things, and that will help. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure. Who else wants to speak? Should I come back on some of that? Paul, yeah.
Yeah, very good, Ian. Touching on some of what Maori was saying about the trade unions, it does appear that some of the key figures in the trade union movement weren't particularly involved in these anti-fascist demonstrations, although some local branches of both unions did publicly support the some of the stand up to racism demonstrations, and other areas around the country have their own anti-fascist organization that isn't necessarily tied to stand up to racism. So, as Ian rightly said, Stand Up to Racism isn't the only group, and in fact, this changes the tone somewhat, because Oxford Stand Up to Racism, well, I think I have issues with Stand Up to Racism anyway. But in Oxford, what happened in Oxford was that I know the two people who directly involved because they're local, and of course I know that they're SWP and Standard to Racism, and of course it is their fight. And what happened was, there was a Muslim American woman who was speaking with the megaphone, and just as she was coming to her end of speech, she then chanted Free Palestine, and that meant a few others joined in. The SWP Standard for Racism stewards didn't like this, and it's on video somewhere, because I've shared it on WhatsApp in a few places. Basically, they pulled the plug on the megaphone, and the steward said, "This is not a Palestine demonstration." Thereby, there's a deliberate failure not to make the connection between what's happening and around the country, and with the connection of Israel Palestine. They are interconnected, and the SWP, despite what they might say in their paper, they are soft Zionist. They support the two-state solution and all that kind of nonsense. So,
True.
So yes, while these anti-fascist demonstrations were very good, standard racism specifically does have its problems here that in Oxford and also in Glasgow, because they've had a cozy relationship with Zionists in Glasgow, which Tony Greenstein has heavily publicised. So I just wanted to make those points. Thanks.
Can I just come in on one small point that you made, which I think you were wrong, actually? The SWP do not support a two-state solution. They do have a one-state solution formally, but their attitude to united fronts is they deliberately keep Palestine out of their stand-up to racism because they want to incorporate elements who support Israel in their anti-racist united front, despite having a reasonable position on one state. I think they're more contradictory than you say they are, actually. Just briefly, but Susan wants to speak. Sorry, that was just a point of information. And then Simon.
Yeah, I was going to say the trade unions particularly, and the gap between, shall we say, the top management of the unions and the grassroots trade union members is most noticeable with the, yes, they're anti-racist, but they continue to try and pretend that anti-Semitism is the same as anti-racism. So I'm not at all surprised about the pulling the plug on somebody saying free Palestine, but I'm also very concerned about the fact that many of the top echelon are very pro-Ukraine, pro-selling weapons to both Ukraine and Israel, and yet at the same time completely ignore the fact that Ukraine is Russophobic, Sinophobic, that it is outrageously racist. It simply chooses which races it's going to be, or which people it interprets as being anti-racist. And it seems to think that as long as it's supporting Israel, it can't possibly be racist, which I find grotesque. You know, this is the double standards are extreme. And it's the gap between the top management, which is very similar to what's happening in the Labour Party. The grassroots are much more pro-Palestine, but the upper echelons of the Labour Party and particularly the Parliamentary Party are incredibly, you know, Zionist. And they seem determined to get rid of any representatives that people have while still demanding that you have to vote Labour if you want. And to get the Tories out, or as we pointed out, you just replace blue Tories with red Tories.
Simon, you had
Yeah.
your. Can I just make a point that
Yeah, I was just going.
if you want to speak, use the electronic hand if you know how to do it. It's on the reactions button. But anyway, carry on, carry on. You're muted.
I found out where that was. Okay. No, I was just going to come back on this thing about the SWP. And Palestine and Israel, etc. I mean, the line has not changed since the 1980s when I first came across it, that they support a democratic secular state with equal rights for Jews and Arabs. That has not changed. Certainly, events I've been to that have been basically under the auspices of Stand Up to Racism, speakers not necessarily wearing their Stand Up to Racism hat, maybe wearing their SWP hat, have made that the connection between what's happening with the genocide and the kind of legitimization it gave a kind of confidence boost to people that wanted to carry out pogroms against Muslims, because that kind of othering and the labeling of the population of Gaza as being dispensable, extremist, uncivilized, etc. That connection was made. It was made by SWP members. And we've had no problem of people carrying Palestinian flags and raising pro-Palestine slogans like From the River to the Sea at those events. That was also in London when there was the counter demonstration against Tommy Robinson's mobilization about a month ago. Maybe there has been some kind of overzealous intervention. Whether this is you know, a national policy of the SWP. I mean, it contradicts what I have witnessed, I just wanted to say. And it kind of does fit the arguments that they have been making, that there is a link between the genocide and what's been happening in Britain recently, and what they've been articulating on demonstrations in Southend, in the Essex area.
Right. Hang on a minute, I just got a message from Max, who seems to have missed the link. Let me just send it again. Hold me a second. Done. Sorry. So who else wants to speak? Sorry. All right, Max wants to get into the meeting cards. I think he's got the time wrong. Can I just make a point about the trade unions, actually? I think the bureaucracy has been very much strengthened by what happened in the Labour Party. The right wing of the bureaucracy sort of reflects what's been happening in the Labour Party to a degree. And there's been the fact that this strike wave a year or two ago really ended inconclusively without a definitive victory for the working class. And it sort of strengthened the inertia of the trade unions and somewhat depoliticized things, I think. And the result, you do see this thing like the TUC motion on defense spending. They're demanding more defense spending, particularly with Ukraine in mind and things like that, you know, which really is a very morbid sign of what's happened to the trade unions at the moment. And there needs to be opposition, organised opposition in the unions, which at the moment there isn't. And I know Tony is working in Unite. I'm a member of Unite, but I haven't really had much time to get involved in this. But Tony Greenstein is trying to organise opposition in Unite around Palestine. And I think that's very important, actually. Although I haven't personally had time to do much about it, but I think we need to give put political input into that, and in more generally the left needs to organise in the unions in a manner that's effective, and you know a lot of the time that the various far left groups the likes of the Socialist Party are. They tend to get absorbed into the bureaucracy, or they don't really participate. You know, I think there's a certain dichotomy in that, which I think the British left has not really managed to solve. And maybe I think that the use of transitional demands in the unions and raising more advanced demands and things like that may actually be something that needs to be considered, at least, you know, because I think a lot of these caucuses that exist in the unions are purely on rank and file level, are quite economistic and just echo slightly more militant demands for, you know, better pay and things like this. You know, there needs to be a more of a political organisation in the unions, but we are a long way from that, unfortunately. The left needs to get itself together. In a more general sense as well, you know, that's my take on it anyway. Anybody else wants to speak on this? Marie?
Yeah, I just saw a friend said something supporting that Diana. She's supporting Israel. Is that and being anti-racist is incompatible? Yeah, I agree with this, and I see that Susan thinks that we should focus on anti-imperialism. I think we should perhaps go back to these ideas because they need to penetrate the working class and they need to penetrate the trade unions. And so it seems to me that if one had some success in Unite, if Tony managed to start something, we could give him a hand and start doing the same thing in other unions. I'm not saying that one drops everything in order to do that, but that could be an activity as well as alongside what we are doing, because the matter of Ukraine is pivotal to the change that's required in the trade unions and in even in the Labour left. You know, the Labour left has not understood the thing of Ukraine. Is that so, right, Suzanne, or do you think I misunderstood you?
Oh no, I agree completely. I was thinking also of the reason I'd put in the neo-colonialism is this business of, UK and Europe going along happily with the negation of Venezuela's democratic election of Maduro, while literally, you know, we're playing nanny. This is imperialist nanny politics. If a popular leader is elected by a majority of its indigenous peoples and is representing the people, it's grotesque to watch the unions in this country, who should know better, not even bothering to bleat slightly against, you know, our ruling class, just simply denouncing Maduro as a dictator when he's clearly not. And the fact, and this morning, certainly the Crispin Flintoff show was explaining how they run the election so that it is absolutely fair and transparent, where everybody's vote is recorded and you get a copy of the vote that you recorded and who you voted for. And you can actually see that. And we are sat there with, you know, the government, when they collect our votes, we're supposed to fill it in pencil, and they take a record of the number of the vote that, you know, the ballot paper we were given. But we don't get any of those records. You know, the idea that, and we get, you know, the postal vote system is even worse, and it's even more corrupt in America. But we are sitting there saying to other countries, you know, your system is rigged. We can't get leaders that we need if we cannot even, trust our own electoral system, but we cheerfully support other countries' regime changing. You know, it is ridiculous. The other thing I would say is the riots. The only thing to be with respect, I thought it was a great speech and introduction, Ian, but the actions of the media were grotesque in the backhanded support of the riots, particularly the endless discussions with right-wing politicians and spokespeople about how justified these people were for the actions that they'd taken, and how there was, it was the fault of the governments for not taking them seriously, because there is certainly no such sympathy for the climate activists or the trade union movement when they are trying to fight poverty and austerity.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Following on from what Susan was saying, actually, I've been talking to another comrade about this a couple of weeks ago. I was struck by, if an ordinary person on the street was saying that, you know, some of the language that get used, you think, well, that borderline incitement at the very least, and so you could expect to be arrested and maybe charged and whatnot. The reason I'm saying it is because I've noticed there is a class aspect to this.
Yep.
What I'm saying is, you know, if you take somebody's racist comment about black or Asian people, and you follow up with a comment that's incitement or considered incitement, somebody else, like 94 Arcs, who's basically a turd in a suit, and get away with it because he's quite middle class, well spoken, and he's also an elected MP. Now, so this goes on to the double standard that Susan was referring to earlier. And I think the media and individuals do really need to be taken on big time, because these rights haven't come in a vacuum. They've been building up for months, years even. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, can I just come back on one thing, the SWP? I think it's probably very, very varied what happens with these groups, this stop the, what you call it, stand up to racism group, because there have been instances where they have invited Zionists to participate and they've told people who objected to go away. I think this is particularly true in Scotland, you know. But their position, you know, the formal position of the SWP has always been a good one on Palestine, you know. So I think it's related to other aspects of their politics. I think the central weakness of their politics on questions of united fronts is a tendency to popular frontism, and we saw that in the anti-Nazi League, where they would seek prominent support. Unite against fascism. One of its sponsors was David Cameron, you know. And if you seek sponsors like that for an anti-fascist initiative, or the anti-Nazi League sponsored by a whole range of politicians, it even got the Federation of Conservative Students to endorse it at one point, you know, and football managers and whatever, you know, that's always been their strategy. And if you do that, you seek respect. You're not building a united front of the workers' movement. You're building a cross-class block, and I think that's the root of the problem with the SWP and its various blocks. You know, Stand Up to Racism is the latest manifestation, but over the years, there are many anti-fascist, anti-racist blocks have always sought a bourgeois component. And therefore, although you will get, you know, a lot of SWP members are very left-wing and very subjectively socialist and anti-racist, you will get these clashes of interest coming in, like in Brick Lane in 1978, where the SWP marched its 100,000 people in the wrong direction to Brixton, where the National Front were in Brick Lane. You know, that was one of the early examples. But, you know, this, you know, Stand Up to Racism with its respectable sponsors, what is it called? Unite Against Fascism with its respectable sponsors. And now this element, there's a fringe element of that attempts, you know, there's an element in the SWP which will attempt to build blocks with, even with Zionists, against the Nazis, against Nazism, against fascism. And still, you know, despite their, you know, their reasonable position, at least in formal terms, against Zionism in favour of a single state, etc., they still have that method, you know, and it surfaces, and it's very, you know, it surfaces, and it's very embarrassing when they get this problem, like that incident in Oxford where somebody basically told someone who's speaking about Palestine to shut up because it's not what we're supposed to be talking about, you know, really quite outrageous, actually. But this sort of thing does happen sporadically, and I think it's linked to their popular front method on, you know, which is not, they don't understand the United Front. They reject the United Front. They build popular front type blocks, even if they don't use that word. You know, that is what they're doing in practice. You know, that's my point about the SWP. Sorry, Paul wants to speak again. And if anybody does want to speak, please use the electronic hand. It just makes it easier to see. You know.
So you basically answered my question, really, because I was having a discussion with someone over the weekend about the difference between a popular front and a united front. And you basically kind of answered it for me by demonstrating how the SWP do tend they like to siphon things off into single-issue campaigns, isn't it? That's popular fantasm, isn't it? That's not united fantasm, is it? Although they use the term united front, but that's not what we would understand as a united front, is it?
Well, I think it's not, just to come back on that, it's not quite that simple, because single-issue campaigns can be quite principled. I mean, IUAFS is a single-issue campaign about Ukraine, you know. It's principled. It hasn't got a bourgeois component. It's a block of several left-wing organisations to protest against the imperialist proxy war in Ukraine, you know. But
okay, then let me ask you the question then. So what is... in a wider sense, then what is the difference between a united front and a popular front?
Popular front seeks bourgeois support, whereas a united front does not. And that is,
okay.
That is the point. And the ANL sought the support of the Federation of Conservative Students. The United Against Fascism had David Cameron as a sponsor. You know. You know, things like that. So it's the crossing of class lines, the building of blocks across class lines. I'm sure you could find examples for UAF, Stand Up to Racism. Well, I'd have to investigate it. But I know what they're like. I know their method. They've done it for many years. And it keeps surfacing. Something weird happens. And the underlying reason is that, you know. Sorry, John wants to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should... be a bit careful here. I mean, the thing is about popular fronts, right, is the difficulty with the SWP is that they don't admit they're popular fronts. That's the problem. Not the problem is the problem isn't popular fronts, because popular fronts can be quite effective. They don't necessarily have to be, that is. Something that's, and this is not the meaning to spite or discuss that, there are certain times that can be important. And in many ways, you know, the anti-Nazi League was more effective, right? It was effective in the 70s. Despite its detractors, it was quite effective. Now, not, and it did confront fascists, there's no doubt about that. You know, the anti-Nazi League did. The problem was, is that the SWP called it a united front, which it wasn't, right? So you know that's the problem. But we shouldn't just rule out popular fronts, you know, full stop. Because I think you know Bob Pitt made the point during the build up to 2003, you know. And I think he had a point, you know. This has got to be debated. I haven't made my mind up about this. But Bob Pitt had a point. There was a platform organised by a Stop the War Coalition, you know, Lindsay German and all this. And he said, look at them. They've got no idea. All they've invited on the speaker list are ex-Trotskyists, right? Who are against the war. Right, now that cuts down the amount of support we're going to get. Now, the right-wing trade union leaders who are against the war, why not invite them to speak and you bring in a broader audience, a bigger audience? Now, that's an argument, isn't it? And we should have that argument, but not like the SWP does and say, oh, it's a united front. No, the discussion should be around... You know, the tactics and whether these things can be effective at times, and we can't just necessarily rule them out by saying, look, the ANL is a popular front and a waste of time. It wasn't a waste of time from what I remember. You know, I was very young, but it wasn't, you know, it did confront fascists and it did mobilise a generation of people against fascism. But the problem was the politics of the SWP. they hid behind it, saying it was a united front when it clearly wasn't. And that's the problem. What we've got to discuss is in certain situations, do we And I haven't got any firm views on this. Do we bring in a wider audience? Do we look at these things and say, well, maybe it is, maybe they are right. Maybe we should have a right wing on the platform as against the war instead of just inviting Tariq Ali and the usual lot along, to broaden the thing. And you've got to look at these things, but don't dress them up and say, that's the United Front, because it's not. Anyway.
Anybody else want to speak? And I might come in on that in a minute, but I don't want to ground stop anybody else from speaking. It's an interesting point of debate, but I'm sure other people might want to say something, so I'll hold my tongue for a little while.
Ian?
Marie, yeah.
Ian, you could come back about making your distinction about Popular Front and so on, about the French situation where they have the way they have got together in order to stop the is it National Front winning the
National. I can come in and say a couple of things, but my point on this is that not everything that involves a bourgeois component is necessarily a popular front. But if it censors and limits its field of activity to appease and keep the bourgeois component on board, then it's a popular front. That's my point. I think the Anti-Nazi League played a certain role in the 70s in mobilising mass sentiment against the fascists. But I think it also betrayed that struggle, because there could have been a really serious defeat for the fascists and they headed it off. And when you've got hundreds of thousands of people mobilised for a carnival, for an event in London, and you march them in the opposite direction from the fascists, when you could have actually swamped them and defeated them quite easily, then that is not a good thing. That was a key point where they could have really crushed them, the National Front, actually, and really humiliated them in a manner that would actually be quite similar to what happened last week in some places like Brighton and Liverpool, They could have done that in 1978, and they didn't. That was the first demonstration I ever went on, by the way, at Carnival 2, where that happened. And that's where I first met the Spartacist League, because they were giving out leaflets saying, go to Brick Lane, go to Brick Lane. And of course, I didn't know what it was about at the time, but I really found out about it later, I think... I don't think popular fronts are useful. I think a united front with bourgeois components can be a useful thing, like a defence case or something like that. That's not a popular front. A popular front is where you censor your overall perspective to appease a bourgeois component. And I think that's a difference. It's perfectly principled to join with some bourgeois democrat in defence of democratic rights. It's perfectly principled for you to unite with some bourgeois politician who wants to defend Julian Assange, for instance. Speaking hypothetically, I know that campaign is now over, but there can be other ones. Now, there's nothing wrong with that at all. Having Charles Kennedy on the platform at an anti-war demonstration does not necessarily make it a popular front. But it would do if you limited what people can say to appease those people like Charles Kennedy or the Liberal Democrats. When the American SWP mobilised with Democrats in the Vietnam anti-war movement, they would stop people from carrying slogans that call for the victory of the NLF in the war, And that was a popular front, because they were stopping, they were censoring the left to appease the Democrats. But just abstractly having a bourgeois politician on a platform, providing he doesn't have a veto what other people say, is not a popular front. That's my point about popular fronts. It's an unprincipled bloc with the bourgeoisie or part of it. But I think the united front is what we should aim for. And sometimes united fronts do include bourgeois figures. If they're not limiting its field of action, then that's fine. You know, it's you have to judge everything concretely, I think. You know, and yes, there were useful things about the Anti-Nazi League. It mobilised young people. Rock Against Racism, particularly, was linked to the Anti-Nazi League, and it mobilised the anti-racist sentiments of young people enormously. And it did help to undercut the appeal of fascism, you know, in the 70s. There's no doubt about that. That was a good thing. But some of the things they did were wrong, and they were dictated by that popular front element of their strategy. That's my view of it. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Sorry, I'm talking too much, and I know that John wants to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, no, briefly. I didn't know that the Sparks were handing out leaflets calling for the march to go to the Brick Lane.
Yeah,
right. I didn't know that. That's very interesting. They were.
Yeah. That was the first...
That's very interesting. Huh?
That was the first major demo.
Right, they were handing out leaflets. That's interesting, because that changes my view on that incident to some extent, because I thought it was a last-minute decision that if they were handing out leaflets, then the SWP leadership were a lot more implicated than I thought. Briefly, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said and that, but, you know, I just think we should keep our minds open, and we should, you know, we should debate, you know, we should take on board the positives of the Anti-Nazi League. I mean, I left the SWP over Time to Go, which unlike the Anti-Nazi League, did nothing for the left of raising the profile of the Irish War, right? And there they operate the same thing as the Anti-Nazi League, and that's the basis I left on in that. And they didn't have any being populist. In fact, the SWP, just to put the record straight, the SWP really demobilised their members from any Irish work, to be honest. And you know, that was their record in the late 80s. And unlike the ANL, you can't argue that Time to Go, that the Popular Front they took up in that worked, that brought in a younger generation, and it didn't. And that was a complete failure of the policy.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Paul wants to speak. Yep.
Yeah, thanks for clearing up that stuff about Popular Front versus United Front. I think it makes a bit more sense now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm trying to read this stuff.
Oh.
Carry on.
Oh, I see. I thought you couldn't hear me.
I can hear you. I'm just trying to
in terms of defending oneself against fascists, I'm getting feedback of my own voice here. Someone's obviously on loud speaker. I think Oxford in the 30s does have a bit of a history, because I think there were a number of Oswald Mosley events where they gathered in the town hall, and of course they used to beat people up and that sort of thing, and apparently the police used to just stand to one side. They did fuck all. But eventually the students actually learned to defend themselves, and one day Oswald Mosley and his fascists ended up basically running away, because the students effectively learned to arm themselves with bits and pieces, and in some ways that's kind of what we need here to to some extent, isn't it? It's not just the case of standing and protesting. You actually need people blocking entries and that sort of thing. And as you say, Oxford in the 30s did have a, you know, they learned, the students learned how to do it. Took a while, but they were successful in the end.
Sure. Anybody else want to speak? Marie?
Yeah. I was looking at the situation just now, the situation in Greece, where Syriza, they made a front with an organization of a far-right organization. And it comes to me how important this discussion is, because Tsipras himself, of Syriza, he had come from the KKE. He had broken. So what we are dealing with here is a situation where there was a general strike, where power could have been tried. I'm not saying they would have succeeded, but one should have tried to take power. But then the Communist Party had broken up, and this Tsipras had organized this organization, Syriza. And then Syriza itself made a front with the right. And that shows how catastrophic such a situation was compared with all the possibilities which there had been. There was all the lessons of having taken power in the world, in other parts of the world, through communist parties. And then the policy of making popular fronts actually demolished the capacity of the communist parties. And I think that's something not to forget, because where would we be now if Greece had succeeded instead of having now all the problems of the right? Yeah.
Oh.
I didn't know about that component with regard to Greece, but I did know that a large section of Syriza did actually come from PASOK, which is a bit like a new workers' party forming, while containing large parts of right-wing of the right-wing of the Labour Party. It's not going to work out. And so I was surprised by that. I didn't know about the right-wing component, but I did know that bits of PASOK ended up becoming part of Syriza. So, if you like, I guess, to use the analogy of United Front versus Popular Front, I suppose Syriza ended up being a Popular Front rather than a proletariat United Front. So I guess that, to a large extent, it well failed. And when it and with the financial arrangements it tried to make with the EU, it was almost kind of to prove it could gift us right wing PASOK, if I remember rightly. So yeah, the whole thing, it was it was all very disappointing and rather sad, wasn't it? Anyway, thanks.
Is anybody want to speak on that? Because I was just going to come back on that very briefly. My understanding is that there was a fragment of the right involved with Syriza, and that it's the basis of the alliance was that they wanted to resist the EU on austerity, at least for a little while. Unfortunately, I don't know who capitulated first, Syriza or this right-wing fragment in Greece, but they capitulated anyway, and they basically imposed the austerity themselves, you know, and therefore undercut their own support. Exactly what the relationship with that, with their alliance with this small nationalist party, what she was, I'm not sure. But I think Syriza had its own internal problems anyway. It was a Euro communist organisation, wasn't it? It was a splinter from the Greek Communist Party. It was also pro-Zionist to a degree. you know, Cyprus actually had his close relations with Israel. I can't remember who the Israeli prime minister was at the time, but it may even have been Bibi, you know. But certainly, you know, it was a very contradictory thing. It was a very flabby organisation that had all sorts of different weird political problems with it, and it wasn't coherent. It may well have been a bourgeois workers' party that was sort of created out of the ruins of previous bourgeois workers' parties in Greece, but it was, you know, it was unstable, and it capitulated, and it had no real political program to fight against the austerity, which was a tragedy, really, you know. But it does show that that you need a party that's based on a program that's going to struggle for that program, that can actually resist things like austerity and bourgeois attacks most generally, and that attacks, you know, alliance, popular fronts with the right wing do sometimes exist, you know. So you could argue that the Russian softness on Trump has an element of that about it, because Trump has made noises opposing the Ukraine war, you know. And so you see elements of that, but people are wising, you know, some of these Russian, pro-Russian activists are wising up now to Trump, you know, because they see his position on genocide in Gaza, and they identify much more with the struggle in Gaza, you know. And Trump is absolutely appalling. But there are elements of that, you know. Sometimes you do get popular fronts with right-wing fragments of the bourgeois politics, you know, over specific issues, you know. It's complicated, you know. Sorry, Marie, do you want to speak?
No, I just wanted to draw attention to what you said. Finally, you said each situation has to be weighed. There cannot be a general rule. Each time one has to measure and analyse. And this is why it seems to me it is important that there's the party functioning wherever one can, so that one is constantly assessing what is happening. This is the reason why. It's not all in order to have a better life. It is in order to actually see what tactic to use at every different point in the situation. Yeah.
Sure. Any more discussion on this? If there isn't, should I stop the recording? We can discuss anything else you want to discuss, if that's okay with people. We always generally have a main point on the agenda and then any other business for these things. So is that a conclusion of the discussion, or do we want to say anything else on this? Quite happy to see it go on a bit longer. If we stop it then, yeah? I'll stop the recording. That's all right. Yeah. Where is the recording thing gone? Where has it gone? Hang on a minute. I'm going to find it first. Here it is. Right, I'll stop the